Verse 18 that says, I know the plans I have for you, where God speaks through the prophets to his people of old, reassuring them of his good purposes for them, despite what has happened to them. And over these weeks of Advent and Christmas leading to the first Sunday in January, we've got a mini-series which follows that kind of theme under the title, So Where Do I Fit In? Looking at some of the people, perhaps familiar characters like Mary and Joseph and others from the Christmas story, and asking that question, where do they fit into the story and what do we have to learn from them? Advent is traditionally the preparation for Christmas, for when we celebrate the first coming of Christ. It's also a time for looking ahead to the coming again of Christ, when God makes all things new and puts everything to rights. But we begin today in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 to 17, which I'm going to read in a short while, where we have the genealogy, or one of the genealogies of Jesus, what you might call his family tree, although I'll say in a moment, it's not quite that. Have anybody here done any research into your family tree? Have anybody, many of you done that? Quite a number. I remember, Rod, you mentioned that on Friday, that you've done a bit of that. I have. And fascinating, my dad's family mostly come from the north of England, mostly the northeast, and most of them, going back as far as I could get to 1800-ish, were coal miners. And my mum's side of the family, with some exceptions, mostly going back to about 1800, were all nail makers, because they're from Bromsgrove, centre of nail making. And I haven't found anybody famous, I haven't found any royal blood, I haven't really found any villains either particularly, so it's fairly mundane, but fascinating for me to get that sense of connection. And I think when people research their family history, that's one of the reasons we have that need as people to know where we fit in, where we belong. It gives us a sense of identity in a very fast changing world. We know that we matter, we have significance, and we've got names. We're not just numbers. Despite what banks and insurance companies and all the rest of it would tell us, we have names. And learning people's names is actually very important. I'm working really hard at learning your names. I haven't quite got there yet. And somebody said the other day, do you feel settled in yet? And the answer is, I won't until I know everybody's names. So I'm working hard at that. And I'd encourage you to do the same. Maybe today, go and say hello to someone and say, I'm really sorry, I've been in this church for years, but I don't know your name. It's embarrassing. It's more embarrassing when you think you knew their name and you get it wrong. But in a church, which could have been this one, about 40 years ago, a young person bounced up to someone and said, hello, are you new here? They got a rather frosty reception because the person said, I have been a member of this church for over 30 years. That's not very helpful. But do take the courage to go and say hello to someone. And if you don't know their name, just say, hello, what's your name? And then keep repeating it several times as you talk to them, and that will help. Talking of names and knowing who we are, there's a lovely old story, and forgive my friends from Bewdley will have heard this before. Jill will have heard it at least three times before. But there's an old story, I believe it to be true, of who was then the Prince of Wales, who became Edward VIII very briefly, and his brother Albert, the Duke of York, who became George VI. And they escaped one day from Buckingham Palace in London and were playing. And they got to know this little Cockney lad. And as boys do, they got into trouble. I think they nicked some fruit from a market stall or something like that. And they were apprehended by a constable who lined them up and demanded to know their names. So you got these three little lads. The first stands up very straight and he says, I am Edward, Prince of Wales. His brother did something the same, sort of, and I am Albert, Duke of York. The little Cockney lad was a bit taken aback by this, and he kind of looked at them, looked at the policeman, and said, I stand with my mates, Gov, I'm the Archbishop of Canterbury. Matthew begins his gospel by helping us to see who Jesus is, where he fits into the story of God, of creation and salvation. And the underlying message throughout Matthew's gospel is that he invites us too to be part of that same story, to be taken up in God's purposes. Matthew ends his gospel with words that we often refer to as the Great Commission, where Jesus commissions his disciples and through them us to go and make others his disciples, bringing his kingdom into the world. So we all are invited to play our part in the story. And do bear that in mind as I read now from Matthew chapter 1 verses 1 to 17. This is the list of the ancestors of Jesus Christ, a descendant of David who was a descendant of Abraham. From Abraham to King David, the following ancestors are listed. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah and his brothers, then Perez and Zerah, their mother was Tamar, Hezron, Ram, Aminadab, Nashon, Salmon, Boaz, his mother was Rahab, Obed, his mother was Ruth, Jesse and King David. From David to the time when the people of Israel were taken into exile in Babylon, the following ancestors are listed. David, Solomon, his mother was the woman who'd been Uriah's wife, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Amon, Josiah and Jehoiakim and his brothers. From the time after the exile in Babylon to the birth of Jesus, the following ancestors are listed. Jehoiakim, Shealtiel, Zerubbabel, Abiud, Eliakim, Azor, Zadok, Akim, Eliud, Eleazar, Mathan, Jacob and Joseph, who married Mary, the mother of Jesus, who was called the Messiah. So then, there were 14 generations from Abraham to David, and 14 from David to the exile in Babylon, and 14 from then to the birth of the Messiah. I have no idea whether I got the pronunciation right, but if you say it with sufficient confidence, people think you know what you're doing. For ancient people, genealogies were very, very important. Some were used simply to show who was related to who. Some were used to prove the ownership of a hereditary office, or maybe to relate the history of a particular group. For the people of Israel, it was also part of their story of who they were. And the one thing we need to recognise when we read these verses is that these are not the same as a modern family tree, where the emphasis is on really making sure you haven't got any gaps at all and you fit everybody in the right place. That's not what Matthew's genealogy is. It's actually very selective. And if you look at 1 Chronicles, chapters 1 to 3, and particularly the lineage of David, or Ruth, chapter 4, you will find different lists, slightly different names. Some names are missing from this list that we've just looked at. Also, Matthew's genealogy is quite different from Luke's at the beginning of his gospel. And Matthew arranges his genealogy in the way he does for at least three particular reasons, and here they are. Firstly, to show how Jesus is descended from Abraham and David, and that he is Messiah. Secondly, to show how God is working out his purposes. And thirdly, to prepare us for the exceptional birth of Jesus. So firstly, to show how Jesus is descended from Abraham and David. The Messiah was expected to come from the line of David. In Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 1, there is a reference to a descendant of David coming from the root of Jesse, David's father. Micah chapter 5 verse 2, which we read about in Matthew's gospel as well, is a reference to Bethlehem, the town of David, being the place from which Messiah will come. And Abraham, we read in Genesis chapter 12, is there to be a blessing for all nations. He and his descendants will be a blessing for all nations. So Matthew, by emphasizing these two characters, ancestors of Jesus, is saying right at the beginning of his gospel that Jesus is Messiah, firstly, and that this good news is for all people, everywhere. Secondly, to show how God is working out his purposes. Did you notice there were three sections of 14 generations? Matthew arranges the names so that there are 14 in each. But as I said, if you go back and look at other genealogies, there are more names than that. Numbers were symbolic for people like Matthew. And in Hebrew thought, 3 and 7 were symbols of perfection. 14 is twice 7, so twice perfection. And also I'm told, I believe this to be true, that in the Hebrew alphabet, the letters have a numerical value. And 14 is the value of David. So again, all the way through, he's emphasizing that Jesus is Messiah and fulfills those prophecies. And that sense that God is working out his purposes through history should encourage us, particularly when things go awry, when things go wrong. And I don't know if you notice, but actually, one of the divisions in Matthew's list of names is the exile in Babylon. When the people of Judah were conquered by Babylon and all the leading people carted off into exile in Babylon. A major disruption, a disaster in the history of the people, and yet even in and through that, God is working out his purposes. And that's where Jeremiah's prophecy that we have as our verse from the year fits in. There are a lot of shady goings on also in the list of names that Matthew gives us, which I'll come to in a minute. But I just want to underline the fact that whatever happens, we can still trust that God is working out his purposes. But how does it do that? How does he do that? Many of you will be familiar with this verse, Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, particularly in the King James version of the Bible, which says, "All things work together for good, to them that love God, to them who are the called, according to his purpose." Many of you will have heard those words quoted. When disaster strikes, well, all things work together for good. And if you know the Latin word omnipotent or omnipotent, that means, usually translated, all-powerful. All-powerful. And if you believe that God is all-powerful, and if you believe that all things work together for good, then sometimes, as a Christian, you can get yourself really tied up in knots trying to explain why something really bad has just happened. I've known a lot of people over the years who have got really, to use a phrase, screwed up, because they've been trying to work out what possible good there could be in the tragedy which has just hit their family. Actually, that's not the only way of translating the word omnipotent, and our resident Latin scholar, James Bell, has helped me out with this and checked it with his teacher. I was told some years ago that another way of translating omnipotent is every possibility. So in other words, we don't think of God so much as God Almighty, making sure everything happens exactly as he wants it to, but that God is the God of infinite possibilities. Nothing is ever beyond God's reach. In every situation, no matter how bad it is, God can still bring beauty and goodness out of it. And that, I think, is reflected in all the modern translations, which are more accurate, I'm told, in terms of reflecting the original New Testament language. So in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. It means that instead of trying to work out what possible good there could be in this tragedy, you're actually able to trust that in the midst of that tragedy, which is awful, God is still working out his purposes. God is still with you. God is still good. And God can bring good out of the most dreadful of situations. So thank you, James, for checking out the Latin. And I find that very helpful, to think that God is the God of every possibility, that nothing is beyond his creative reach. And he works in and through the messiness of people's lives, as we will see in a moment through some Old Testament examples, and also in the New Testament. If you read the letter to Corinthians, you will discover a really messy church. Not because they did craft activities, but because they were in a real mess. And yet Paul, writing to them, emphasizes the fact that God is still at work among them, and he raises their sights to remind them of who it is they're meant to be. And God works in and through the ordinary messiness of life, the day-to-day stuff, because he's working in and through ordinary people like you and me. People of flesh and blood, people with hang-ups and backgrounds and issues and illnesses and stress at work and lack of work and kids in the back of the car squabbling. I've told you that one before, so I won't go on that again. But thirdly, the main reason Matthew writes these words and puts these names in is to prepare us for the exceptional birth of Jesus to an unmarried mother. One of the unique things really about this genealogy is the fact that Matthew includes the names of women. I know. Women in a genealogy, because you don't do that. You only have the men, because they're the only ones that matter, because they're the ones that carry the name on, aren't they? So I didn't mean that, Maureen. It's all right. But it is really unusual. And what's more unusual is the women that Matthew actually chooses to include. There's no mention of Sarah, the wife of Abraham, or Rebecca, the wife of Isaac, or Rachel, the wife of Jacob. Instead, we read about Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. Well, why include them? Unless there's a particular reason for doing so. There must be some reason for having these women in the genealogy, particularly when you read about their stories. Tamar we read about in Genesis chapter 38. She was married to Ur, a son of Judah, who was a son of Jacob, also known as Israel. She was widowed and childless, and to cut a very short, a very long and very unhappy story short, Tamar disguised herself as a prostitute in order to seduce her father-in-law so that she could have children. Oh, and she was probably a Canaanite. In other words, she wasn't one of the people of Israel. So that's Tamar. Rahab certainly was a Canaanite. We read about her in Joshua chapter 2. And she was a real prostitute. She lived in Jericho and harboured two Israelite spies. Ruth was a Moabite, again, not one of the people of Israel. And like Tamar, she was widowed, and she goes to extraordinary lengths on her mother-in-law's advice to secure a husband, a man called Boaz. And then there's Bathsheba. Bathsheba, who, as Matthew points out, was married to Uriah the Hittite, 2 Samuel chapter 11. Bathsheba was seduced by King David, who makes her pregnant, and he then arranges for her husband to be killed in battle so that he can marry her. Their first child dies, but she later gives birth to Solomon. My goodness. What a mess. Four women who were either Gentiles, not Jews, not the people of Israel, or associated with Gentiles. In each case, there's something highly irregular about them or the manner in which they had their children. And we have to say, why include them, Matthew? You know, why draw attention to these women? You could have just named the fathers. We'd have moved swiftly over the names. We wouldn't have been having to face these difficult stories. What about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David and Solomon and Uzziah and Hezekiah and Josiah and all the rest of them? Why draw attention to the women? What if it was uncomfortable for Matthew's first readers? It's also uncomfortable for us, isn't it? You know, we don't like to think about stories like this. They're the sort of skeletons in the cupboard, aren't they, that we'd rather not think about. But actually, what comes next is even more shocking. And the reason Matthew has drawn attention to all these women and to their rather iffy stories is for what he's about to say, which is that the Messiah is born to an unmarried mother, almost certainly in her teens, and there is suspicion that she's been unfaithful to her fiancé, all highly irregular and unconventional, at least in that day and age. And friends, even if we believe, as I do, that the child Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit, let's not lose sight of the shocking nature of how God became man, the Word became flesh, because that's what Matthew's preparing us for. Even if we believe in the miraculous conception of Jesus to an unmarried mother, a mother who, Mary, as Mary in her own words said, had never been with a man, even if we believe that, this was still pretty risky on God's part. Risky because there was the danger of misunderstanding. And there was. The pictures that I've included on the PowerPoint are taken from the 2010 BBC dramatisation of the story of Christ's birth, which actually presents Mary as a virgin, which includes angels and God moving the planets into place so that the star shines over the place where Jesus is born. Quite amazing to have that on primetime BBC television. It's been repeated since. And yet, a vocal minority claiming to represent Christian voice in this country complained to the BBC about it. And at the heart of their complaint was the way in which the villagers in Nazareth reacted to Mary getting pregnant, and Joseph got very angry because he thought that she'd been with another man. Well, yes, that's the point. That's what's in the Bible. God's ways are not our ways. And we surely would not have chosen that way. You and I'd have played it safe, wouldn't we? There would have been a respectable family for this to happen in. There wouldn't have been this question mark hanging over Jesus, possibly for the rest of his life. And what's more, hanging over Joseph, who we'll hear about in a couple of weeks' time. What was it like for him to have to live with people going, ah, couldn't wait, could he? Or poor Joseph, somebody else got there first. You know, people talk. And God still does things in ways that we wouldn't recommend. And he makes good use of our mistakes. No matter how many times we mess up or how big a mess we make of things, he chooses unlikely people to do his work, including those whose birth, upbringing, or marital background is unconventional, and including those whose ethnic background is different from those who see themselves as superior. He takes what seems weak or foolish to us and he demonstrates his wisdom and his power. He takes the most unlikely people and he brings them together in churches like this one to incarnate the truth of God. Let's remind ourselves of some words that the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. And in Ephesians, the letter that we've been working through in recent weeks as a church, we read these words. When it came to presenting the message to people who had no background in God's way, I was the least qualified of any of the available Christians. God saw to it that I was equipped, but you can be sure that it had nothing to do with my natural abilities. And so here I am, preaching and writing about things that are way over my head, the inexhaustible riches and generosity of Christ. My task is to bring out in the open and make plain what God, who created all this in the first place, has been doing in secret and behind the scenes all along. Now hear this. Through Christians like yourselves, gathered in churches, this extraordinary plan of God is becoming known and talked about even among the angels. You think he can't use you? Think again. But recognize that this happens as you and I think less about how God can make our lives better and more about what our lives can mean for God. God most certainly uses our mistakes. He uses the mess of our lives. And in and through that works out his good purposes, bringing beauty, as the old saying is, from ashes. And yet, God doesn't want us to stay in the mess. He doesn't want us to stay screwed up. He doesn't want our lives to be one continual crisis after another. He wants to bring healing and wholeness and maturity to us as we discover him working in us and among us and through us as his people gathered together. That's what the church is for, to enable us to grow as disciples of Christ into maturity with Christ as the head. To be transformed by the love of Christ in the realities of life, as the church mission statement says. You think he can't use you? Well, read Matthew 1 again and think again. I may encourage you to use Advent as a time to reflect on what the coming of Jesus Christ means for each one of us. And when the day comes to celebrate his birth and we give thanks for God's gift, let's be ready to give ourselves to him. Amen. Let's take a few moments just to be quiet. And in the quietness, make that your prayer. Offer yourself again to God. And trust him to be at work in you and through you, so that by your life and your prayers, his kingdom may come. And his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Jesus, take me as I am. I can come no other way. Take me deeper into you. Make my flesh life melt away. Make me like a precious stone, crystal clear and finely honed. Life of Jesus shining through, giving glory back to you. Amen.